Thank you very much. Is it working now? Thank you very much for the kind introduction. I'm grateful to the Fields Institute for hosting this program and to the two organizing, Matt and Ross, for organizing it. The request to give the Kokseter lectures specified that the first one is supposed to be broadly accessible, and this one, I hope to make it very broadly accessible. And just don't think that the lectures tomorrow and the day after will not be the same level of accessibility. I'm sorry. So I will talk about logic and computer science. And I want to start with a quote to a good colleague of mine, Georg Gottlob, professor at Oxford. He says, "Computer science is a continuation of logic by other means." Of course, it's a paraphrase of a very famous quote. Anybody knows? Von Clausewitz, right? "War is the continuation of diplomacy by other means." But if we stop to think for a minute about logic and computer science and the connection between them, it is actually rather surprising. When you talk about logic, for most people, maybe not people in this audience, but if you stop in the street, people will say, well, if they know anything about it, some branch of philosophy, some old dry branch of philosophy. Then we have computer science that gave us YouTube and Facebook. What is the connection between these disciplines? And Mr. Cosmar Chalisi from the Sanof Institute put it very nicely on his webpage. He said, if in 1901 a talented and sympathetic outsider had been called upon, say by a grant-giving agency, to survey the sciences and name the branch, it would be the least fruitful in a century ahead. His choice might well have settled upon mathematical logic, an exceedingly recondite field whose practitioner could only fit into a small auditorium. It had no practical application, not even much mathematics to show for itself. Its crown was an exceedingly obscure definition of cardinal numbers, whatever they are. But before delving deeper to understand the connection of logic and computer science, we really ought to ask a more fundamental question. What is logic? It is not so easy to define what logic is. We may want to go to the most famous logician of all times, the Everland Charles Ludwig Dodson, also known as Lewis Carroll. And indeed, in Alice Through the Looking Glass, we find the following, contrariwise, continued Tweedledee, if it was so, it might be, and if it were so, it would be, but if it isn't, it ain't, that's logic. That this was the 19th century definition. If you want a 20th century definition, you can go to a book, Words of Power, by a feminist author, Andrea Nye, and she said, logic is the creation of defensive male subjects who have lost touch with their lived experience and define all being in rigid provisional categories modeled on primal contact between male and female. But if we want to become serious, we may have to go back, way, way back, to the most influential intellectual of all time. Who is this guy? Aristotle, who lived in the 4th century BC. His wisdom stood unchallenged for about 2,000 years. That's pretty good for any intellectual. So Aristotle was interested in a very basic question. He says, how can we distinguish philosophy from demagoguery? Philosopher literally means lover of wisdom. Philosophia. Demagogue literally means leader of the people. Demagogue, leader of the people. How did we distinguish philosophy from demagoguery? How do we find the truth? Francis Bacon, 1605, said, very nicely, he said, logic differs from rhetoric in this, that logic handles reason exactly and in truth. And rhetoric handles this as it plants in popular opinions and manners. So this is a search for the truth. And Aristotle has made a very fundamental discovery. Truth comes out of form. Now, why is this surprising? Because most of us were told the form is not relevant. Look inside, look inside. The truth is somewhere inside. Aristotle says, look, that the form determines the truth. That's why we talk about formal logic. So let me give you an example of a syllogism. It's a pattern of reasoning. Lewis Carroll called it syllogisms. And here is a famous one, all humans are mortal, all Greeks are human, therefore all Greeks are mortal. And everybody would acknowledge the validity of this reasoning. Here is another one, all Bujums are slithy, all Tovs are Bujums, therefore all Tovs are slithy. And looking at it, you might recognize this is equally valid, even though you have never seen a bujum, you don't know what is a tov, and you definitely have no idea why they are slizy. But this is valid reasoning because of the form. So truth come out of form, very fundamental. Now the Greeks discover one more thing, very important, the paradoxes. The Greeks love paradoxes. You all have heard of the Zeno paradoxes. The most famous paradoxes, of course, is the liar paradox, usually attributed to Epimenides, who was a Cretan, who said all Cretans are liars. In fact, in Epistle of St. Paul to Titus 1:12, we read, one of themselves, a prophet of their own, said, Cretans are always liars, evil beasts, lazy gluttons. You didn't know that about them. In fact, we can go to the Old Testament, Psalm 116:11, everyone is a liar. Now, to really make it a paradox, we have to sharpen it. This is due to Eubulides, who said this sentence is false. And if you want to do an experiment, try it on children. And if it's too young, maybe age 8, they will just be confused. But somewhere around 10, 11, they start realizing there is a problem here. There is a problem. And you can go with them. If it's false, it must be true. If it's true, it must be false. We don't seem to resolve it. And today we understand this all because of self-reference, or as we say mathematically, diagonalization, referring to the diagonal of a matrix. What happens in medieval period? On one hand, not much, but I want to talk about Ramon Llull. Ramon Llull was a Catalan monk who was quite a sinner in his young age and then had epiphany, become very devout, and went on a mission to convert everybody to Christianity. And what better tool than logic? This is an argument for the truth of the Trinity by logical arguments. So please listen very, very carefully. It's a very delicate argument. If in thy three properties there were no differences, the demonstration would give the D to the H of the A with the F and the G as it does with the E. And yet the K would not give significance to the H of any defect in the F or the G. But since diversity is shown in the demonstration, the D makes of the E and the F and the G with the I and the K, therefore, the age has certain scientific knowledge of thy holy and glorious Trinity. Capiche? You couldn't follow? Don't feel bad. You're not, again, the only one. Let's go back to Francis Bacon, who said, some persons more ostentatious than learned have labored about a kind of a method not worthy to be called a legitimate method, begging rather a method of imposture, which nevertheless would no doubt be very acceptable to meddling wits. Such was the art of Llull. So in fact, if you didn't like this argument, here is a Renaissance painting, the stoning of the philosopher Ramon Llull. He went to North Africa and he tried to convert the population there to Christianity using this kind of argument, and this is what happened. So why am I mentioning Ramon Llull? Well, to be fair, I made a bit too much fun of him. All these letters are actually simply symbols for some assertion that it was written, he explained, somewhere else. But he did discover something very important. He discovered that when you use logical reasoning, you must deal with case by case. You must do case analysis, and you have lots of cases. Right? So today we talk about combinatorial explosion, which you realize. So the challenge was how to even enumerate all the cases to consider. And so he came up with an idea of mechanical aid. So this is from his book. This is a nice title for a book. It says Ars Magna Generalis and Ultima, which means great general and ultimate art. That's the title of the book. And the idea is this piece of paper, would you be able to rotate them with a pin and therefore generate different combinations, all the different combinations you need to generate. So this is, as far as we know, the history of ideas. First time that somebody is coming up with the mechanical aid to reasoning. Of course, people have done way before the mechanical aid to computation. Abakai goes back God knows how many years. But this is the first time somebody says reasoning is computationally hard. We need some aids. Here's some idea how to do mechanical aid for reasoning. And this idea had a lot of influence on a very important person, Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz, the man who is famous for one of the co-inventor of the calculus, but also invented binary notation. So many people call him, he was the first computer scientist, he invented the bit. Okay, the binary digit, the bit. Leibniz was a prodigy. He taught himself Latin at young age, started reading Aristotle, And he wrote two theses about Aristotelian logic, one about metaphysics and one about logic and the law. And he discovered Lul. He wrote, "When I was young, I found pleasure in the Lulian art." And out of these primitive rotating circles, he came up with an amazing idea. And this is the idea of universal mathematical language. He called it lingua characteristica universalis, in which you'll be able to express all human knowledge. And furthermore, there will be calculational rules, calculus ratiocinator. And of course, Leibniz knew about calculus. Also, he built actual calculators. And using this machine, you'll be able to derive logical relationship between different assertions. So if controversy were to arise, there will be no more need of disputation between two philosophers than between two accountants. So it suffices to take their pencils in their hands and say to each other, "Calculemos, let us calculate." So Leibniz is saying we'll be able to completely mechanize reasoning. This is an incredibly bold idea. Unfortunately, Leibniz did not get to carry his program too far. First, of course, he didn't know how hard it was. Secondly, he did not have an academic position. Unlike his nemesis Newton, who was professor in Cambridge, he was the chief librarian of the Duke of Braunschweig, and his main task was to construct the family tree of the Braunschweig family, which was very deep, was high monstrosity. And he spent much of his time traveling in Europe, digging in dusty archives. And much of what he wrote was not published in his life, and he wrote voluminously. But the story was that when he died, unlike Newton, who received state funeral and buried in Westminster, he was only his secretary attending his funeral. So the story goes. And then there was really no one to carry his dream. And we have to wait about 150 years to George Bull, who described of a man of acutest intellect and malifaux learning. And I have to say, I just love this phrase, and I think of putting in my will, "Please write this on my gravestone." It is so nice. So George Bull is born in 19th century England. His father is a shoemaker. 19th century England, if your father was a shoemaker, what are you going to be? A shoemaker. But he was a very, very bright young man, completely self-taught, taught himself mathematics, start tutoring students, then start tutoring teachers, and end up being a professor of mathematics in Queen's College in Cork, Ireland. Last I heard was the fight about the house where he lived in was still there, but was a bit old, and there was a fight to somehow raise the money to preserve it and reconstruct it. I'm not sure where it stands. Now, Bull has, a very important insight. So 19th century is a century that algebra is discovered, right? So algebra before that was just a way to only things that ruled law that we know about the real numbers and maybe complex number. But suddenly in 19th century, people realized you can do algebra abstractly, and Bull realized you can do logic algebraically. Okay, so when you look at the algebra, where it came from, goes back to Bull. So let's read a paragraph from his book. He says, "If an adjective as good is employed as a term of description, let us represent by a letter as Y all things to which a description good is applicable, i.e. all good things, or the class of good things. Let it further be agreed that by the combination X times Y," here we use the algebraic convention of multiplication by just juxtaposition, "so X times Y shall be represented the class of things to which the name all description represented by X and Y are simultaneously applicable. Thus, if X alone stands for white things and Y for sheep, let X times Y stands for white sheep." So basically, Bull is saying conjunction can be treated as multiplication. Now, what was his goal? This is from his book, The Mathematical Analysis of Logic, 1847. And his goal is pretty amazing. He says, "The design of the following treatise is to investigate the fundamental laws of the operations of the mind by which reasoning is performed." So this is the beginning of what we call today cognitive science. Someone says, take the mind. Before that, people thought this was something divine, the soul, and now Bull wants to have nothing less than a mathematical theory of the mind. This was such an audacious program that really after him, nobody dared touch it again. Almost for 100 years, 1943, Pitts and McCullough come with neural net as a new model, proposing a mathematical model for the mind. So let's see what Boole thought he can do with algebra. So just like we've been hearing today about idempotence, Boole says that conjunction should be idempotent operation, because white and white is still just white. So now we have a new axiom, x equal x times x, and now we do a sequence of algebraic steps, x minus x, x is 0, we factor out x, and we get that x times y minus x is 0. Ooh, he said, this is very important. This is the principle of contradiction. Something cannot be true and false at the same time. This is probably one of the most fundamental principles that we use up to this very day in mathematics, proof by contradiction. And he wrote, this is the principle of contradiction, which Aristotle had described as the most fundamental axiom of all philosophy. So the algebra gives us philosophical insight. Boole, again, did not get to carry his program too far. He was 49, he went to teach. It was raining, he got really soaked, wet, caught pneumonia, came home with high fever. His wife had a strange belief. The remedy has to be similar to the cause of the disease. So she put him nicely in bed, then poured on him a bucket of ice water. And that didn't help. And so he died at a relatively young age, left behind a family, very impoverished family. He had a daughter, Alice. She was 4 years old when he died. She didn't remember much of him. Grew up, got little formal education, became just a secretary, got married, had children, except she had one hobby, which was four-dimensional geometry. So she started corresponding with some professor in the Netherlands. They started publishing together, and she ended up, without ever finishing high school, getting an honorary doctorate from that university in Groningen. So now the pace picks up a little bit. Before that, we saw we had to wait sometimes hundreds of years from one step to the next. But now Boole is immediately followed by William Stanley Givens. Givens was very much inspired by Boole, and there are interesting correspondence between them where he strongly disagrees with Boole. He read Boole's paper, he can make sense of it. He writes very aggressive letter, and Boole very nicely responds, explains things to him. So here is what William Stanley Givens writes, and I have a few choice quotes. He writes, "I have given much attention, therefore, to lessening both the manual and the mental labor of the process." The process is logical reasoning. "And I shall describe several devices which may be adopted for saving trouble and risk of mistake." So again, somebody is realizing, I mean, finally today we understand that even Boolean reasoning is NP hard, but all these people are saying, this is very hard. Let's do something about it. So what did he do? He actually built a machine. This was called logic machine because of the shape. This is called the logic piano. And it could handle four propositions. So the state space was 2^4, was 16. The case space was 16 different cases. And if you think this should be easy to do, let's see if you can do it with moving wooden pieces. So he built a machine, a logic machine. Now, again, if you're not impressed, he was very impressed. He wrote, "As I woke in the morning, the sun was shining brightly into my room. There was a consciousness on my mind that I was the discoverer of the true logic of the future. For a few minutes, I felt such a delight, such as one seldom hopes to feel." So I will tell graduate students, that's what they're supposed to feel every morning. Now, what he really did, also something very important, what we call today Boolean algebras, really due to Givens, because what Boole himself used, he did exclusive or rather than inclusive or. And then you don't get such a nice algebra if you do that. So what we call really Boolean algebra should be called Givens algebra. Now again, remember, this is a machine that can handle four logical propositions. And look what he writes. He writes, "The machine represents a mind endowed with powers of thoughts but wholly devoid of knowledge. It cannot be asserted, indeed, that the machine entirely supersedes the agency of conscious thought." This is based on this is really the philosophical ramification of still today we think about artificial intelligence, and all of this already was raised by Givens. The final comment I find is very, very ironic. He says, "I must remark that mechanical devices are not likely to possess much practical utility. We do not require in common life to be constantly solving complex logical questions." Of course, he did not attend the Field Institute workshops, right? But it is also, ironic, because if this is logical piano 1.0, well, you can say this is logical piano 100.0. This is the Pentium chip. If you ask an electrical engineer, what is this? She would say, this is the logic of the circuit. Right? This is the logic of the circuit. So somehow logic went from thing that philosopher or mathematician dealt with to building computers using logic. How did this come about? Now, the conventional wisdom attributes this to a very bright young student, Claude Elwood Shannon. Now, many of you have heard of Shannon, and he's very famous for inventing information theory. But he did this in old age, when he was 28. What did he do when he was young? So, at age 21, Shannon published a master thesis. It was titled, A Symbolic Analysis of Relay and Switching Circuits. And really what Shannon realizing in master thesis is the connection between logic and circuits. Because when you a switch can be closed or open or closed, so this is 0 or 1, true or false. And so this connection, and you can connect circuits in sequence, in series or in parallel, and that gives you conjunction or disjunction. So this was a very profound connection between logic and circuits. Hermann Goldstein, who we will meet in a few minutes, he was the project manager of the ENIAC, the first digital computer. He wrote, the thesis helped to change digital circuit design from art to science, because now we have a mathematical theory for circuit design, which is Boolean logic, Boolean algebra. Howard Gardner, professor at Harvard, said, possibly the most important, also the most famous master thesis of the century. Now this is probably a bit overhyped, because one thing you need to realize is it's unlikely that a master thesis was being widely read at the time, even a master thesis at MIT. Today you can find it on the web, but at the time it was probably not get a lot of attention. And in fact, you can go and ask, how much did people know about it? So we can go to the people who build computers, the early pioneers, Atanasoff and Zuse. And they apparently says, we never knew, we never heard about Shannon, we never heard about his work. They did their own work. And many pioneers say that they didn't really learn about algebra and circuits until much later. Here is a quote from a book from 1971, Digital Design by R.K. Richards. Boolean algebra was something less than a major influence in invention and design of early electronic computers. The 1950s were well underway before the algebra was used at all. Some of the major pioneer electronic computer organizations. At the same time, this connection between circuits and Boolean algebra was actually discovered by other people. So the people who built the Colossus, Max Neumann and other people, already knew about this connection, even though they didn't know about Shannon's thesis. And we can find papers going back 1941, 1936, all the way back, Paul Ehrenfest in 1910, that made this connection between algebra and circuits. And in fact, we can go even back to the 19th century. And we're going to meet there a figure of mysterious greatness, Charles Saunders Peirce, a man of many talents. He was a mathematician, an astronomer, chemist, geodetist, surveyor, cartographer, metrologist, spectroscopist, engineer, inventor, psychologist, philologist, lexicographer, historian of science, mathematical economist, lifelong student of medicine, book reviewer, dramatist, actor, short story writer, phenomenologist, semiotician, logician, rhetorician, and metaphysician, of course, all this in his spare time. And of course, you can see from this that we can spend a lot of time talking about Charles Saunders Peirce, but I'm going to jump and talk about his students. In 1886, Alain Marquand, Peirce's students, published an article in the Proceedings of the American Academy of Arts and Science titled A New Logical Machine. Charles Kendall Adams, who was then the president of Cornell, was quite enthused and wrote to him, Dear sir, please accept my thanks for your new logical machine. Could you invent the machine that will do the work of a college president? I give you my order in advance. Peirce read the article, liked it very much, and he writes to Marquand and he says, it's time to build machines for very difficult mathematical problems. It's time also to go from 4 propositions and moving wooden pieces to the new technology, electricity. So he said, I think electricity would be the best thing to rely on. And he actually Peirce goes to draw diagrams, how to do, using connecting things in circuits in parallel, how to do addition and multiplication using circuits. As far as we know, Markan did not follow up on it. We have no record of this happening. Peres was a philosopher. He never built anything. But that was what he thought was enough to start thinking again. This is 19th century, and he's thinking about computers. Here is 1889. A logical machine is a machine which, being fed with premises, produces the necessary conclusions from them. The value of a logical machine seems to lie in their showing how far reasoning is a mechanical process. So we have this thing going back to Lull and then Leibniz, and now Peres says reasoning is a mechanical process. Furthermore, he says calculating machines are specialized logical machines. So reasoning, logic can be mechanized, and if you can do logic, you can do computation. And again, he goes to reflect about the philosophical implications. Precisely how much the business of thinking a machine could possibly make to perform, and what part of it must be left to the living mind, is a question not without considerable practical importance. I show this quote to people and I say, who said it? And some people say, John McCarthy. And other people say, Alan Turing. But this is all done, this is still late 19th century. It's quite amazing. Now, I want here to make a switch, because until now, when I talked about mathematical logic, it really meant that we're using mathematics to shed light on logic. But there is a reverse meaning of mathematical logic, which is using logic to shed light on mathematics. And I want to start by mentioning Eugene Wigner, who write a very influential paper called On the Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics in the Natural Sciences. And Wigner starts by just giving us quotes going back to the antiquity, how important mathematics always been perceived to be in the natural sciences. So Euclid said, the laws of nature are but the mathematical thoughts of God. And Galileo said, the universe cannot be read until we have learned the language and become familiar with the character in which it is written. It is written in a mathematical language, and the letters are triangles, circles, and other geometrical figures, without which it is humanly impossible to comprehend a single word. And Wigner goes on to enumerate numerous instances of the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics in the natural sciences. The universe is mathematical, and he concludes what he called the empirical law of epistemology. The mathematical formulation of the laws of nature is the correct language for formulating the laws of nature. Now, other people have went on to ask the questions, why? Where did the universe learn mathematics? Why does the universe behave mathematically? Is it possible that we have another civilization and they have advanced science and they formulate the laws of nature somehow without mathematics? But I want to ask another question. There is an implication there that by mathematicizing the universe, we are somehow moving to a higher level of precision and reliability. And indeed, if you survey all the intellectual discipline, you ask yourself, which one is considered the most reliable? Right? I'll give you your choice, which one you think is the least reliable. But most people would somehow think that mathematics really is on a different level than every other discipline. And why is that? Because mathematics has one thing that no other discipline has. It has proofs. This magical thing that the legend is that when Pythagoras and his students discover Pythagoras' theorem and the proof, not the theorem, the proof, they slaughter many oxen as a gift to Apollo for this wonderful gift. Really, it's a gift from the gods. What is a proof? Some people call a proof the high road to truth. It's an argument that is so tight, so compelling, it leaves no room for doubt. Once you've gone through a proof, that's it. It is over. The discussion is over. In effect, to comprehend the importance of proofs in mathematics, again, we go back to the 3rd and 4th century BC, and we meet the most influential mathematicians of all time, Euclid. He's not considered the best mathematician, that usually reserved for Archimedes, but he wrote a textbook that has been used unchanged, really unchanged, for 2,000 years, and today we still use some variants of it. Okay, so elements of Euclid was used for many, many years unchanged to teach geometry. In fact, go back and think of your own high school education. On one hand, you had geometry. Geometry was deductive and logically perfect. You couldn't say, well, these two triangles, they look overlapping. They look congruent. You had to have a precise argument why this is so. On the other hand, algebra and calculus, the teacher gave you a bunch of recipes, they seem to work. When you ask why, the teacher said, because I told you so. So you just had to follow them. And for many years, geometry was the queen of mathematics. And algebra and calculus were the peasants. And then we have a reversal in the 19th century. First of all, we already, Descartes has shown how you can reduce geometry to analysis by analytical geometry. And then Bolyai and Lobachevsky discover there's nothing special about Euclidean geometry, just one more geometry, other are possible. And then through hard work by many mathematicians, Bolzano, Cauchy, Cantor, Dedekind, Weierstrass, the calculus finally was formalized from a bunch of recipes to something which is rigorous and become deductive. But in that process, a problem has arisen. If we said that the key thing in mathematics is to have rigorous proofs, the question became, what is a rigorous proof? In particular, what about the infinity that lurks at the heart of analysis? And this is an old controversy in mathematics. Again, we can go back to Aristotle, who said, infinitum actu non datu. There's no actual infinity. But already in the 4th century, St. Augustine disagreed. He wrote, in individual numbers are finite, but as a class are infinite. Does that mean that God does not own the numbers because of their infinity? No one could be insane enough to say that. In a wonderful book by Amir Axel, The Mystery of the Aleph, Aleph being a mathematical symbol for the infinite, he writes, first discovered by the Greeks between the 5th and the 6th century BC, all the paradoxes by Zeno are all about the infinite. The concept of infinity was so overwhelming, so bizarre, so contrary to every human intuition, it confounded ancient philosopher and mathematician who discovered it, causing pain, insanity, and at least one murder we know of. The student of Pythagoras was murdered by his fellow students. And in fact, in 1874, Georg Cantor proves there are infinitely many distinct infinitives. And of course, how does the proof proceed? By diagonalization again. Our old nemesis comes back. And so if it was bad enough to argue about one infinity, how can you argue and discuss infinitely many infinities? And now this is not a philosophical conundrum, but a mathematical controversy. Leibniz, I'm so in favor of the actual infinite, in self-admitting that nature abhors it, I hold, that nature makes frequent use of it everywhere. Gauss hated it. I protest above all the use of infinite quantity is a completely one, which in mathematics is never allowed, verboten. If you use infinity, this is not a proof. Kronecker also hated it. When he saw the Bolzano-Weierstrass theorem, he called it obvious sophism. Hilbert loved it. No one should be able to expel us, he wrote, from the paradise that Cantor created for us. To this very day, some people refer to set theory as the Cantorian paradise. And Frege wrote, for the infinite will eventually refuse to be excluded from arithmetic. Thus, we can foresee that this issue will provide for a momentous and decisive battle. And such a battle it has become, and when it became such a battle, it wasn't just a professional battle, it became a really ugly fight, and the most famous instance of this is a fight in the 1920s between David Hilbert, we're going to meet David Hilbert in a few minutes, and Bauer, a Dutch mathematician, over what is mathematics. And Hilbert was the editor-in-chief of Mathematische Annalen, which was the mathematical journal. He wanted to kick Bauer off the editorial board, and it was complicated. How could he have the authority, how to do that? And all the editorial board got dragged into this fight. They had to be with Hilbert or with Bauer. Only one editor wrote, I refuse to get involved in the war between the mice and the frogs. Of course, another classical Greek comedy. The name of this editor was Albert Einstein. Here we see Frege. Some people describe him as the second most important logician after Aristotle. Friedrich Ludwig Gottlob Frege. And I think many of these people we see their picture when they are old, partly because I think, I don't know, cameras were only became available later. Also, they're only famous when they're old. So what is Frege's contribution? So remember Leibniz's dream, which was having a language for all human knowledge. Well, Frege is really the person who took it on. He asked a very simple question. What is the language of mathematics? If you ask someone, they'll say, well, it is some combination of natural language and some symbol, but what is really the language of mathematics? And Frege proposed a logic which essentially is first order logic. He says we have mathematical objects, we have predicates, relationship between them, we have operations on them, functions, we have Boolean operations, and the thing that Boole didn't have but came Peirce invented, quantifiers. For all, there exist. So we can go back to the Aristotelian syllogisms, and a sentence that says all men are mortal. To be more formal, you say for all men, for all X, if X is a man, then X is mortal. And now we have this notation, logical notation, that emerged in the first part of the 20th century, and we use the inverted A for all X, man X implies mortal X. Von Hayernut, who wrote an influential anthology from Frege to Gödel, wrote perhaps the most important single work ever written in logic. I beg to differ, because nobody can surpass Aristotle's book that introduced logic, but maybe the second most important single work ever written in logic. And then enters the picture Bernard Arthur William Russell. Again, we see here a picture of him when he's an old man, but he gets involved when he is about 30 years old. And on June 16, 1902, he writes a letter to Frege. And the letter starts very nicely. I find myself in agreement with you in all essential, writes Russell. I find in your work discussion, distinction, definition, the one seeks in vain in the work of other logicians. There's just one point where I've countered a difficulty. This minor difficulty became so severe that when a year later, in the next year, Frege's book comes out, you find in the appendix as follows. There's nothing worse that can happen to a scientist than to have the foundation collapse just as the work is finished. I've been placed in this position by a letter from Mr. Bertrand Russell. There was quite a lot of correspondence between them, but eventually Frege accepted the criticism, which to him was basically his life work, which was logicism, which was formalizing mathematics on top of logic. He viewed it, it was destroyed. Everything that he's done was done in vain because there was essentially a contradiction in his work. His work was inconsistent. At the end of his life, he became a very bitter man. He hated everything that he didn't like, which included the parliament, democracy, liberalism, Catholicism, the French, and above all, the Jews. He became a virulent anti-Semite. Now, this happened in the 1920s. Nazism is rising. It's a kind of a very unsavory end to a distinguished intellectual career. So what was this minor difficulty that Russell found in Frege's work? Well, Russell realized, and this almost intuition that goes back to, again, to Boole, that the central concept is a collection of objects that we choose to label in some way. We call today a set. So Russell tried to formally define what is a set, and discovered he couldn't do it, because he couldn't decide if the collection of all sets that do not include himself as member is a set or not. Now this sounds a little bit like a tongue twister, so Russell gave a beautiful analogy. He said, consider a small town, and all the men in this town, they form a set, and there is a barber who's also a man, and this barber says that he's going to shave, he shaves all men, and only those men that do not shave themselves. And now the question is, what about himself? If he shaves himself, then he shouldn't. If he shouldn't, then if he doesn't, then he should. And again, we have a paradox. And this is exactly like the liar's paradox. Epimenides has essentially spoken from his grave after 2,500 years of slumber. And Russell has launched what became known as the foundational crisis in mathematics. Now, what's interesting is that apparently other people were aware of this little difficulty, but they thought of it as just a little, you know, joke on the side. Here is a little peculiarity. And Russell didn't want to say, wait a minute, this means we do not have a rigorous definition of a set. We cannot go on. This is a problem. And Frege accepted it. Now Russell himself launched a project, Principia Mathematica, in which he wanted to remedy the situation. This was an incredibly challenging project, he wrote in an autobiography. Every morning, I would sit down before a blank sheet of paper. Throughout the day, with a brief interval for lunch is important, I would stare at a blank sheet. Often when evening came, it was still empty. It seemed quite likely that the whole of the rest of my life might be consumed in looking at a blank sheet of paper. So he needed some help, and he went to his colleague, Alfred North Whitehead, and they have been able to produce Principia Mathematica. It took them 10 years. They produced 3 volumes, 2,000 pages, in which they show how to derive systematically mathematics from logic and avoided the paradoxes by essentially restricting. You couldn't have self-referencing. Tactically, self-reference was abolished. Russell wrote, "My own intellect never quite recovered from the strain of writing it. I turn aside from mathematical logic with a kind of nausea." So again, if I talk to graduate students, don't write a 2,000-page dissertation. Now, at first, people were very excited. It seems that Russell has found a problem and then solved it. But then people realized, wait a minute, Frege wrote a small book and Russell found a paradox in it. Now we have 3 volumes, 2,000 pages. How many knows how many paradoxes are hidden between the lines in Principia Mathematica? So the crisis was on. And into that crisis step, David Hilbert, who is at this early part of the 20th century, he is the king of mathematics in a sense that he is the one mathematician everybody acknowledges is the greatest mathematician. Already, and before he was 40, he gave the invited talk at the International Congress of Mathematics, the first one in 1900, posed 20 plus problems that really shaped mathematics in the 20th century. There are many, many legends about and stories about Hilbert. I'll tell you my favorite one. Hilbert comes to the university, to his office one day, and the students realize there is a tear in his pants, and you can actually see his underwear. And no one knows what to do in this case. How can you go to such a famous mathematician and say, "Hey, Professor Otto Hilbert, we can see your underwear"? So for a whole week, the students debate, what should we do? And eventually, one of them has a brilliant solution. He goes to Hilbert and he says, "Hey, Professor Otto Hilbert, I hear that the roses are blooming. The roses are in bloom. Can I invite you to walk to the rose garden and talk mathematics on the way?" And Hilbert loved nothing better than walking and talking mathematics. So they go to the rose garden, and he drags him to the thickest part of the garden. And they come out, and he says, "Oh my God, one of the roses must have torn your pants. I'm so sorry. It is all my fault. I will pay for the repair. I will pay for new pants." And he apologizes profusely. And Hilbert starts feeling so sorry for him. He says, "Don't worry, don't worry." In fact, he says, "I will tell you a secret. It's been going on for a week. Does no one notice until now?" Hilbert was not primarily a logician. He was a classical mathematician. He became famous because he took geometry, he took Euclidean geometry, and finally took Euclid's work and put it really on a rigorous setting, found a missing axiom, missing inference rule. It was not so simple as Euclid designed it. And he was greatly disturbed by the crisis and decided something has to be done. Hilbert's program was something, the theorem has been said only after he died, people start referring to Hilbert's program. What he wanted is to build a defensive wall around mathematics. He wanted to prove that, first of all, that mathematics is consistent. There are no paradoxes. He didn't like paradoxes at all. Secondly, mathematics is complete. All true mathematical statements can be proven. There are no unknowns in mathematics, he claimed. Unknowables. And finally, and this is where computer science is starting to be born, he saw that mathematics was decidable. There's going to be a mechanical process to determine whether a mathematical statement is true or not. So he wanted to really make mathematics beyond any doubt. Again, let's read what he wrote about this program where he wanted to dispose of the foundational question once and for all. He wrote, "Every mathematical problem must necessarily be susceptible to an exact statement, either in the form of an actual answer to the question asked or by the proof of the impossibility of its solution." So of course, we know that many things that people wanted to do, square the circle, trisect an angle, cannot be done, but there were proofs that they cannot be done. And then logic. Once a logical formula is established, one can expect that systematic, so to say, computational treatment of logic formulas is possible, which would somewhat correspond to the theory of equations in algebra. So again, if you go back to what we did in high school, what we really taught for algebra and calculus were algorithms. Everything was solved algorithmically. And Hilbert believed that this should be extensible to all of mathematics. The last quote I like very much, because it really is more emotional than intellectual. He writes, "Every mathematician certainly shares the conviction that every mathematical problem is necessarily capable of strict resolution. We hear within us the perpetual call, there is a problem, seek its solution, you can find it by pure reason." And I think for many people, this describes why they went into mathematics. And the idea was that if I have not solved the problem, it's because I have not thought hard enough, I'm not smart enough, not because there's somehow it's impossible to solve this problem. In 1930, Hilbert retired, with mandatory retirement. The city of Königsberg played an important role, of course, as you know, in graph theory. It made him honorary citizen. He was from Königsberg originally, was invited to, he got the keys to the city, invited to give a radio address. And in fact, I have a recording of the, you can hear Hilbert giving radio address called Natural Philosophy and Logic. And this 5-minute address ends with very famous 6 words, Wir müssen wissen, wir werden wissen. We must know, we shall know. And this is what's written on his gravestone. Wir müssen wissen, wir werden wissen. Now please pay attention to the date, September 8, 1930. It's a very important date, because Hilbert program is just about to collapse due to important work by Kurt Gödel, who first shattered the first 2 legs of the program. First of all, incompleteness. He showed that in arithmetic, there's no systematic way to derive all true arithmetical statements. And then the impossibility of proving consistency of mathematics within mathematics, the second incompleteness theorem. And finally, a few years later, Church and Turing proving unassailability even of first order logic. There's no way to mechanize mathematics. So all 3 legs were completely destroyed. And everything starts by Kurt Gödel. Kurt Gödel, as a young boy, was called Herr der Warum. Warum means why. And he only wanted to go to the heart of the matter. If he didn't understand something, he asked why. When given explanation, he just applied recursion and ask again, but went to the reason, ask why, and you could never satisfy him. He kept asking why. And so he was known as Herr der Warum, Mr. Why. This is now we're starting to see a picture of young people. I like this picture very much. This is Gödel and Einstein when they're already both in Institute for Advanced Studies at Princeton. There's about 30 years of age difference between them, but they became very good friends. They would walk together to work and walk back together. And it was said nobody ever dared to interrupt the conversation by Gödel and Einstein. So, September 7, Königsberg, 1930. There is a conference on the epistemology of the exact sciences. This is one day before Hilbert is going to give his radio address. There is a panel session at the end of the conference. And Gödel very quietly, he's a young man. I mean, Hilbert is a famous mathematician, and he is in his late 20s. And he mumbled something like this. One may in fact exhibit sentences which, although intentionally correct, meaning true, are not provable in the formal system of mathematics. Very few people understand what he is saying. But he is stating the incompleteness theorem. But there's one person who understands it immediately, and this is John von Neumann. John von Neumann at this stage, is a prodigy, he's a rising star. I mean, he was a prodigy already at a young age. When he was 6 years old, he was already multiplying 8-digit numbers in his head. Just to test yourself, try to multiply 3-digit numbers in your head. The story was that he would exchange jokes with his father in classical Greek. His father was a professor of the classics. His father wanted him to get a profession, so he sent him to ETH in Zurich, and he got a PhD in chemical engineering. But his father didn't know that at the same time he was doing a PhD in mathematics in Budapest. At the same time. Now he's about 20 years old, and he is working within Göttingen on Hilbert's second problem, the consistency of arithmetics. And he, when soon as he heard Gedel, he says, "Oh my God, I've wasted 2 years of work." He was very upset. He was a very vain man, and he wrote, "I will have nothing more to do with logic. I will never read another paper in logic." He didn't keep his this promise, fortunately for us. But we will come back to von Neumann in a few minutes. I also mentioned Alan Turing. Here is a nice picture of Alan Turing, Alan Matheson Turing. Many people don't know that he was a great mathematician, but wasn't particularly a nice guy. Next year is going to be the centenary. It's going to be the 100th birthday. There will be many, many events about Turing. None of them will mention, will have such a title, I bet. So, what happens there? Something amazing happens. And this is really the person who caused the downfall of Hilbert's program is Hilbert himself. Because he asked a very important question nobody's asked before. He took the most important concept in mathematics is that of a proof. But that concept was, until that point, extra-mathematical. It was something a mathematician do, not something the mathematician study. And Hilbert says, "Wait a minute. This is the most important concept in mathematics. We must study it." He started proof theory. And what is a proof? A proof has to be, of course, very rigorous. What does it mean, rigorous? Rigorous, people came to understand the rigorous mean it has to be so precise, a machine should be able to check it. Checking your proof should not require creativity. What does it mean, machine should be able to check it? We have to formalize machine checkable. Out of this formalization of machine checkable came computer science. So all the fundamental concept in computer science came up in a short spurt of creativity in the mid-30s, the concept of an algorithm, the procedure for solving mathematical problem, which people have done, again, since Euclid. But it was not a mathematical concept. And the distinction due to Turing between hardware and software, the Turing machine, and the instructions for the machine, the concept of universal machine, a universal Turing machine can solve all computational problems given the proper instructions, and even the lambda calculus due to Church, the first programming language, still to this very day, the foundation of many functional programming languages. Here is a nice painting. It's called the Universal Turing Machine, and it shows Turing and the tape, and we're going to hear a lot about Turing in the coming year. Now, all of this is happening. These guys are mathematicians, they're theoreticians, they're worried about foundational questions. Unbeknownst to them, people are building computers. Here is the picture of the ENIAC. And what we see here is Betty Jennings and Francis Bilas programming the ENIAC in 1946. There was no programming language then. To program the ENIAC, you had to set switches, hundreds of switches, and you have to connect cables. And if you did one wrong, it wouldn't work. It required tremendous patience and precision. And everybody believed that only women have the capacity to do it. And only later, programming became easy, and then men took over. And now comes back von Neumann. Last time we saw him was 1928. Now we are in the 40s, and Hilbert died in 1943, and he is now the king of mathematics, and he's the last king of mathematics. After him, mathematics became just too big and too diverse to think that there is one mathematician who can stand there on a mountain and see all of mathematics. And again, there are many, many stories about von Neumann. Let's see, one of my favorite ones, he spoke very fast, he was very, very fast in everything. He wrote on a blackboard incredibly fast and apparently erased it equally fast. So on February 14, 1946, the ENIAC is being turned on in Philadelphia. The ENIAC was an engineering high monstrosity, high degree of monstrosity we heard today, 18,000 vacuum tube, about 3,000 cubic feet, 30 ton, 150 kilowatt. The story was that when it was turned on, lights in Philadelphia dimmed because it was using so much power. And it was blazingly fast. Can you imagine 5,000 number, 5 kilohertz? Can you imagine? 5 kilohertz machine. It was a marvel of engineering. The people who built Eckhart and Mauchly were great engineers, did not have much of theoretical basis. In August 1944, Hermann Goldstein, the manager of this project for the Navy, this was a project for the Navy, the purpose of the ENIAC was to compute ballistical tables for naval guns. The Navy was producing many, many guns, every gun needs tables, it was very time consuming, and Hermann Goldstein meets von Neumann in Aberdeen, Maryland, in train station. And von Neumann, of course, at this point is God. He's an incredibly famous mathematician. Hermann Goldstein sees him and he goes to introduce himself. Von Neumann was actually a very gregarious man, start chatting with him, and of course asked, like all mathematicians, what do you work on? And Goldman says, we're building a computer, and start explaining. Von Neumann got very excited. He says, I want in. Nobody could say no to John von Neumann. He was in, and at that point, the ENIAC design was finished. They were actually building it, and they were designing the second generation, which was the EDVAC. And in June 1945, a report came under the name of John von Neumann, a first draft of a report on the EDVAC. A year later, another report, preliminary discussion of the logical design of electronic computing instrument. And in this report, von Neumann described how to build a computer. Now this is where he puts his idea, what we call today the stored program computer, the von Neumann architecture. The program is not external to the computer, it is actually also processed by the computer itself. And we find that these papers are technical memoranda, they don't have a single reference, but you read them, and of course you see the traces of Boole and Turing, so you can see that he clearly continued to read logic papers. He was very excited. You have to remember, this happened after he was the head of the mathematical efforts of the Manhattan Project, and now he's into computers. He says, I'm thinking about something much more important than bombs. I'm thinking about computers. And by the early 50s, small computers or big computers, they're called JONIACs by now, is a nickname on John von Neumann, are built all over the world. People read von Neumann's memos and they know how to build computers. And the Leibniz dream has come true, and the circuit has been closed. We went from reasoning to patterns of reasoning to logic to computers, and now we have computers that can reason. And this takes us up to the mid-40s. Of course, it will take me a long time to try to describe what happened in logic since then, in the last 50 years. But I will just say that logic has taken such an important role in computer science that some people call it the calculus of computer science. Playing the same role in computer science that calculus plays in other engineering disciplines. Some people argue that logic has been more successful in computer science than it has ever been in mathematics. If we go back to our friend Cosmar Shalizi from the Santa Fe Institute, he writes, one extremely important field, however, it, meaning logic, reigns supreme. That is computation. Programming is simply mathematical logic in action. The melding of theory and practice is so complete that most practitioners have no idea that their speech, recursion, lexical scope, data abstraction, and even those bane of sea novices, pointer referencing, dereferencing, this is all logical prose. But one cannot talk about the success of logic without thinking about the success or lack of it of logicians, the personal story. This was put beautifully by Christos Papadimitriou in a book review in 2001. And he writes, and then there's a human story, the unbelievable and total sadness of it. Leibniz never had a chance to advance his dream, and he was consumed by his famous row with Isaac Newton over the simultaneous invention of the calculus. Boole lived in poverty and died relatively young of pneumonia, having walked to his lectures through rain. Cantor died in deep depression, his ingenious work ignored. Although Frege's reputation survived well the fact that Russell found his system, it was marked forever by his vehement racism and anti-Semitism. Hilbert lived until 1943, in a strange denial of the evil that was destroying his country. Whereas Gödel fled to Princeton, was possessed by an advancing paranoia, he starved himself to death in 1978. He believed that someone was trying to poison him. He only trusted his wife to cook for him. His wife had to go to the hospital, so he did the logical thing, which was stop eating. Still, the most tragic end is Turing's. His apparent suicide in 1954 was presumably the result of his continued persecution by the country. He is so brilliantly and crucially. Of course, as we know, he played a crucial role in the British war effort by code breaking. After the war, it came out that he was homosexual. He was prosecuted and persecuted for it, subject to estrogen shots, became depressed and committed suicide in 1954. To this said list, one may add that von Neumann died in 1957 from bone cancer, which was incredibly painful. At the time, they did not have enough pain medication. But also people say it was very painful for him because it was the first problem he encountered that he couldn't solve by sheer intellect. And that was to him very, very painful. Now, after talking about how sadly logicians do in general, I do want to comment in computer science we treat logicians much better. And there's a long list here of logicians who received the Turing Award, which is the people said the Nobel Prize in computing, starting with Rabin and Scott in 1976, Tony Hoare in 1980, Ted Codd in 81, Steve Cook from University of Toronto in 82, Milner in 91, Knoelly in 96, and 3 or 4 years ago, Clark, Emerson, and Sifakis. All of these people doing work in the interface between logic and computer science, and their work received very high recognition. So I do want to tell you that you've seen that Epimenides is dead. He's alive and well. He just moved to the humanities, where you hear less about it today, but a few years ago, the hot thing was postmodernism, where the main dogma is there is no universal truth, and all you have to do is look at this and say, okay, but is this universally true or not? And I will finish with a quote of Leibniz, who described by Norbert Wiener the patron saint of cybernetics. Cybernetics was an old term for computer science. And let me just read the second paragraph, which I like very much, where he writes, once the characteristic numbers are established for most concepts, mankind will then possess a new instrument. It will enhance the capabilities of the mind to a far greater extent than optical instruments strengthens the eye. And I think this is the best definition I can think of for what computer science is. Thank you very much.